On this week's 51%, a psychoanalyst shares her views on prioritizing motherhood.
One of the reasons to write the book was to advocate for what we don't have in this country, which is a paid maternity leave. We're the only civilized country in the world that doesn't value the mother-child relationship.
We hear from women working to see climate bills passed in their state, and a sexual assault prevention program trains staff in bars and restaurants. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. The impact of a mother's physical and emotional presence on a child's well-being is a topic of great debate in the United States, and in today's society, the need for financial stability, coupled with a contemporary push for gender equality, has given birth to a rise in the number of parents working outside the home. But what effect does the daily physical absence of a mother really have on her child? Psychoanalyst Erica Komisar argues that research shows it is one of the triggers of social disorders in children. Her argument, however, has become somewhat controversial. 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall recently spoke with Komisar about her new book, Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters, and asked Komisar how she came to write the book.
I'm a parent guidance expert, which means that I see parents who are starting to maybe have signs of difficulty with their children, and they come to someone like me for help. And over the past 30 years, I was seeing an increase in mental disorders in children, very young children, under the age of 5, who were being diagnosed earlier and earlier and medicated earlier. And it was really concerning to me as a practitioner. And I was seeing a connection in my practice to the absence of mothers on a daily basis in children's lives. And then I started looking at the research going back 75 years. You know, the research really backed up what I was seeing in my practice.
What did you find exactly?
What I found is that mothers are biologically important, really biologically necessary in the first 3 years of a child's life, what we call the critical period of brain development. At about 3 years old, a child's 85% of a child's right brain or their social emotional brain is developed. And so it's why we call it a critical or sensitive period of brain development. And mothers serve a really important function at that time. One, they regulate a baby's emotions from moment to moment, meaning every time a mother soothes a baby in distress, she's basically keeping that baby's emotions from going too high or too low, bringing that baby back to what we call homeostasis. And that, after 3 years, can be internalized by the baby as the ability to regulate their own emotions. The other critical thing that she does from a biological level is she protects the baby from stress, which she does something called buffering from stress. Basically, what we understand now is that babies are born essentially neurologically fragile, much more fragile than we thought. And then a mother basically protects the baby from the stress in those first 3 years. And at the end of those 3 years, the baby can internalize resilience to stress. Even though that serves a very critical function at a certain point, in the first 3 years, you need that sensitive empathic nurturing.
Interesting. Now, what does that mean for mothers in today's culture?
What it really suggests is that we really are not spending nearly enough time on our children. The Pew Research Trust did a study that said we're spending between 60 and 90 minutes a day as working parents on our children under the age of 1. And based on what I just told you about emotional regulation and stress buffering, it's just not enough time to have healthy, emotionally healthy children.
So what are some of the prescriptive things that you write in the book to the different types of mothers?
So what I say is more is more. The more emotionally and physically present you can be for your baby in the first 3 years, the better off, the better chance that baby has of being emotionally healthy. But some women have to work. And so some of the things that I suggest for those that have to work is be aware of transitions. The transitions are very important for very young babies, meaning your comings and goings. Many women who leave in the morning and feel badly about leaving don't say goodbye to their babies, you know, or leave enough time, meaning we're always rushing today. And the idea is that babies move at a very slow pace. They need a lot of transition time. So that means spending a lot of time in the morning, you know, with your baby before you leave, making sure you say goodbye. And when you return, it's what we call the reunion, spending a lot of time on the reunion. A mother who works, for instance, is not going to be able to come home at 6 o'clock and put her baby to sleep at 7:30. It's just not enough time for that baby to reconnect with that mother. So that baby may need, you may need to be more flexible and let that baby stay up much later and even, you know, even sleep with you. I mean, babies who don't get their mothers during the day tend to need them more at night.
But what about dads?
Dads are also important. From an evolutionary and biological standpoint, dads have always served a different function in terms of nurturing, meaning mothers and fathers both produce something called oxytocin when they nurture. Essentially, oxytocin is, some people call it the love hormone. Mothers produce it when they give birth, when they breastfeed, when they nurture, and makes them more sensitive empathic nurturers, meaning when a baby is in distress, it makes the mother lean into the pain to soothe the baby in distress. Interestingly, when fathers care for babies, they also produce oxytocin, but it comes from a different part of their brain, and it produces a different behavior in fathers. It makes them more playfully stimulating. It makes them throw the baby up in the air higher, tickle the baby more, distract the baby from pain, and help the baby to separate from the mother, meaning explore the world.
Non-traditional families, you know, maybe two dads or one single dad, what kind of prescriptive advice would you have for families like that, where the mother's not around or, you know, not accessible in a different way than just that she's at work?
Well, you know, we have a diversity of families now, and the idea is that you need a primary caregiver who's going to be the sensitive, empathic nurturer. If I work with two gay men, I'll say, which one of you is going to mother this child? And, you know, mothering can be done by a man, but if we're going to ask a man to be a sensitive, empathic nurturer, and it doesn't necessarily come naturally to him, then you need to teach that man, and which is what I do. A father can be taught, you know, and a father who's a primary caregiver, whose wife is working, can be taught to be the sensitive, empathic nurturer and primary caregiver.
How do you address the mom guilt? How do you help someone reconcile that?
The thing about guilt, and this is really a critical part of the book, is that guilt really isn't a bad feeling. Guilt is what we call a signal feeling. Essentially, it's like physical pain. Guilt means that we're in conflict about something. We feel conflicted internally. And society has been telling women for many generations just to turn away from their guilt and don't worry about it and your baby will be fine. And what we're finding is that babies are not fine. And that sometimes when mothers look at their guilt and resolve their conflicts, rather than turn away from their conflicts, they make better choices for themselves and their babies. Not all mothers have the same choices, but all mothers have some choices.
What do we do about all of this?
One of the reasons to write the book was to advocate for what we don't have in this country, which is a paid maternity leave. We're the only civilized country in the world that doesn't value the mother-child relationship. And that's really critical. We do not offer women the ability to be with their babies in the first year. And essentially, it's the first 3 years that mothers have to be as present as possible. So what I advocate for in the book is a year of paid maternity leave and another 2 years of women with the ability to work part-time or flexibly so they can have that control that they need over their lives to be as present as possible for their babies.
You had spoken to the Wall Street Journal about the difficulties that you faced once this book came out. A lot of people were angry about it. Some people loved it. But I just want to kind of address the controversy that something like this might bring up in today's world.
I think it made the far left sort of feel as if I wasn't on board with the idea of gender equality. And, you know, the issue really is that I believe in gender equality, but I also believe in gender difference. So, you know, we've been doing things from an evolutionary stance and a biological stance in terms of nurturing for thousands of years. You can't just switch that up in 10 minutes. You know, you really, there's going to be consequences for that. And then on the right, the conservatives, who are very family-oriented, embraced me, but didn't want to pay for what I'm advocating, which is a year of paid maternity leave paid for by the government.
So you kind of fell headfirst into the politicization of motherhood.
Fell in the crack in between, too, you could say. I mean, I would say if I was going to get out two messages that are, I think, critically important for the book, is you can do everything in life as a woman. You just can't do it all at the same time. More is more. The more physically and emotionally present you can be for your child in the first 3 years, whether you're a working mom or a stay-at-home mom, the better off your baby will be. And, you know, these are really, really important messages. And I have one more message, which is in the years that you're raising your child, let your work be boring and let your child be interesting.
That was psychoanalyst Erica Komisar speaking with 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Her book is entitled Being There, Why Prioritizing Motherhood in the First 3 Years Matters. There's a new program in Ulster County, New York, to help prevent sexual assault. The Ulster County executive says the program that provides bystander training for bar and tavern staff is the first such program in the state. County Executive Mike Hine says the Ulster County Bystanders Against Sexual Assault program has been launched in the college town of New Paltz with the help of the New Paltz Bar and Tavern president and town police.
The people who are owners of these establishments, they want their people to feel empowered. We want their people to feel empowered, and we want to be in a situation where we put an end to sexual assault. And this is the kind of innovative thinking that will get it done.
Currently, 3 bars are participating in the pilot program: P&G's Restaurant and Bar, McGillicuddy's Restaurant and Tap House, and Murphy's Restaurant and Pub. Establishments that have completed the training will receive a certificate designed so that SUNY New Paltz students and area residents will know that the establishment cares about preventing sexual assault. The program stems from the county's Crime Victims Assistance Program. Cynthia Kraft is Enough is Enough coordinator and Ulster County Crime Victims Advocate at SUNY New Paltz. She says the idea for the program came from a tactic that has spread through social media and around the globe, asking for an angel shot. It's where women who need help out of a bad date or unsafe situation at a bar or restaurant go to the bartender and ask for an angel shot, code for please help. Kraft decided to reconfigure this, taking the onus off the victim and designing a training program with offender behavior in mind.
What it comes down to is that most offenders offend against multiple people. So if we can stop one offender, ultimately we're preventing multiple assaults. And that's kind of the premise that we kind of ran with.
Kraft says the program seeks to change the culture that, knowingly or not, supports sexual assault. The idea is to help the bars in Ulster County send a clear message that certain behaviors will not be tolerated and to create a safe space for everyone. Kraft and a colleague facilitate the training and conducted a few in the fall, and she shares some warning signs that are covered in the training.
What we're trying to get them to look for are, you know, that aggressive person who's not taking no for an answer. The group that is using catcalls or put downs, just verbally harassing customers. The person who comes in and perhaps buys one drink, but is watching to see who's drinking a lot or ordering a lot of drinks for a particular person. Those types of behaviors that may indicate they're there for a different reason.
Town of New Paltz Police Chief Joseph Snyder says bar and tavern employees are on the front lines in being able to help prevent sexual assault.
Really, they're the eyes for us out there. So their ability to be trained to look for warning signs, to identify potential issues and or a potential victim based on whether over intoxication, whether being left alone by other friends, or seeing somebody that appears to be a perpetrator, particularly eyeing someone out, will be beneficial. And then getting the police involvement or calling for a ride or stopping them from leaving by themselves. It's a great program to assist, and that's why I think New Paltz is a great location for this to be a nice program to try out here.
Again, Hine.
This is really about all of us together working to be able to make sure we put an end to this and once and for all say enough's enough and have it mean something.
Kraft notes that about half of all sexual assault perpetrators are under the influence of alcohol at the time of the assault. She hopes more New Paltz establishments will come on board and ultimately other bars and taverns elsewhere in the county. Hine hopes the program will serve as a model to be replicated across the state. So does Snyder.
I definitely think that this is something that should be shared across the state. We're kind of like the trial town for this training, but the buy-in that we're getting from the employees of the taverns has been awesome.
Kraft says there are some training programs outside New York that focus on bystander training, such as one called Safe Bars in Washington, D.C. A group of businesses in western Massachusetts has announced a formal effort to combat human trafficking. Led by MGM Springfield, a casino set to open this year, local business leaders from the hospitality and transportation industries have been meeting on the issue since 2017. Social worker Jen Falcone is coordinating the efforts, and she spoke with 51%'s Paul Tuthill.
We know that a majority of human trafficking in our country is related to sex trafficking, and we know that that sex trafficking often takes place either in hotels or in apartments or condos or things like that. So this is something that has been on the hotel's radar screens for a while in the area. They've already been doing some training around it. And we also know that trafficking victims get transported. They get moved on buses or trains or planes or cabs or things like that. So those are two places where if employees are educated in what to look for and how to respond, they can really make an impact and put a stop to trafficking.
And so specifically, what is being done by this coalition?
We started meeting a little less than a year ago, and we started out just by saying, you know, what do we want to do and how can we make an impact? We've had a couple meetings with law enforcement for them to tell us about how we can be helpful and things that we can do. We've talked about different trainings that are available for businesses, for their employees. And our latest effort was to put together this pledge that our coalition members could sign on to, as well as hopefully start bringing other businesses on board and really make it clear that the greater Springfield area is not a place where human trafficking is tolerated.
Are they bringing expertise to the table in this, given what, what they must have experienced in Las Vegas and other places where they've operated casinos for decades now?
Yeah, well, a lot of the casinos, the MGM casinos, kind of operate independent of each other. Certain casinos within the MGM family have gotten awards around the human trafficking piece, especially their security personnel, and their casino over in Macau has also been awarded for their efforts around human trafficking. But there hasn't been so much of a broader push corporate-wide, and we're really hopeful that this kind of Springfield effort could be the beginning of something bigger across MGM.
Okay, you mentioned there's a pledge involved in this that the businesses sign up for.
The main points of it are increasing awareness among staff, protecting against human trafficking in our places of business, and collaborating and advocating across the local community. You know, it's great that we have this growing awareness that most people, when they think of human trafficking, they're imagining people from other countries that have been shipped over here in shipping containers, and that's the majority of the time, that's not what we're talking about. You know, we're talking about, you know, our neighbors, our friends, you know, our women and children really being exploited right under our noses.
That was Jen Falcone speaking with 51%'s Paul Tuthill about an effort to combat human trafficking. The tagline the environmental community is using to spur climate legislation is 100% for climate action. It's one that's gaining support from a variety of stakeholders in the state of Washington, business leaders, and city council members. And though they may not agree on the exact language in bills making their way through the state legislature, their show of support for carbon pricing could thread the legislative needle. Martha Baskin reports from a climate lobby day in the state.
Climate lobbyists, most of them volunteers, take a break after a briefing on carbon pricing and clean energy bills being debated in the legislature. Jeannie Murphy is an environmental educator with the City of Seattle.
My concern is all these young people that I've been working with, what kind of future are we leaving them?
She's here to build momentum for climate policy.
I feel like this is a movement that will keep building on itself.
Kathleen Finney from Spokane is in Olympia for the first time, but has been concerned about climate since she was in high school.
My particular focus is on biomethane for vehicle fuel, so using waste, the gas that comes off of that, to fuel vehicles. So I see that as a really big solution that we can implement right now.
For those who've been lobbying on climate issues for years, getting a carbon tax over the finish line is their laser focus. Tight margins between Republicans and Democrats make conversations about complex things like climate challenging, says Mo McBroom, director of government affairs with the Nature Conservancy.
That said, I think the tone in Olympia is different this year than it has ever been before.
Public demand, federal inaction, coupled with a broader understanding by the business community of the cost of a fossil fuel economy, wildfires to threats to natural resources like timber and shellfish, is moving the needle, says McBroom.
And that has translated into what feels like a very broad base of support and new voices who are coming out urging the legislature to take action.
Carmen Mendez, who serves on the Yakima City Council, is one of those voices. Mendez says she's always believed in the science of climate change. Protecting her community and the future of her young daughter from wildfires and drought is what brought her to Olympia to testify on behalf of the governor's carbon tax bill. The bill is winding its way through the Senate as Senate Bill 6203. She wants it to include monies for clean energy projects like wind and solar.
Yakima has a phrase that we have 300 days of sunshine, and the irony of that is that we are not utilizing those 300 days of sunshine to store our energy, solar energy, and send it to the grid and use it later when we have the ability to do that.
Growers and other industries are wary of the word tax, says Mendez. But if a carbon tax includes revenue to invest in clean energy and the jobs that go with it, thinking may change. Washington Business for Climate Action is also speaking out for a carbon tax. They want to make sure carbon pricing is done right, says co-chair Stacy Smedley, who is director of sustainability at Skanska USA Building. She says the organization's 250 businesses have a stake in crafting legislation that works for them.
One of our key points is the reinvestment of the money needs to be for things that are proactively reducing emissions and also alleviating some of the stress on businesses that are going to be impacted by that.
The Senate carbon tax bill would charge $20 per metric ton of carbon, with 50% of the revenue allocated for carbon reductions, 35% for water and forest funds, and 15% for low-income programs. Some climate lobbyists say the tax should be higher, a minimum of $25 per metric ton, with 7% yearly increases. But Representative Joe Fitzgibbon, sponsor of a low carbon fuel standards bill in the House, is encouraged that the business community is weighing in.
The fact that they're supporting move forward on carbon pricing is a major step, and I think that's one of the things that has the potential to change the outcome this year.
Representative Beth Dolio says there's tremendous momentum to pass significant climate policy. Climate impacts in the state may be playing a role.
I think people are recognizing that it's costing the state a tremendous amount of money to fight these fires, to deal with floods. And so dealing with climate and making meaningful reductions in the greenhouse gases that are emitted in this state is becoming a much more important issue to many people.
Dolio, who's worked on climate solutions for most of her professional life, says her own sense of urgency also springs from the fact that she's a mother and wants a healthy planet for her children and future generations. On this particular Climate Lobby Day, hosted by Audubon Washington and Climate Solutions, the room is equally divided between men and women, young and old. But there's no question that women are playing a critical role in making sure the state takes action. Not only do they believe climate change is real and a problem, says Sherry Cornell, executive director of Washington Women for Climate Action Now.
But they know that there are solutions, they've heard about them, and they believe that if our leaders do the right thing, that we can make a difference.
The perspective of women leaders is important, says Mo McBroom with the Nature Conservancy, along with the holistic solutions that women often bring to the table. At the same time, it's important to have
strong voices coming from communities of color, from our tribes, as well as business leaders.
Everyone needs to be a part of the dialogue
to ensure that we get this done well and that it works for everyone.
As the strategy session wraps up, volunteer climate lobbyists gear up to meet their legislators. They've been convinced about the urgency of their cause. Now they're ready for climate action. This story was brought to you with support from the Human Links Foundation, engineering by Daniel Gunther. From the studios of the Jack Straw Cultural Center, this is Martha Baskin.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1490.